Yeah, we have two people crossing. We will now hear argument in Three Lower Counties Community Health Service versus Maryland Department of Health and Mental Hygiene. Ms. Gilotti?
Yes, Your Honor. Good morning. My name is Kathy Gilotti. I'm appearing on behalf of Three Lower Counties. If it pleases the court, I'd like to get right to the heart of the issue here. There's a lot of history here. This is not the first time that Three Lower Counties has appeared before this
Indeed.
Court. But I would like to just get right to the issue of what are the remedial limits under 42 USC 1983. And we believe that the district court misapplied the holding in Will versus Michigan Department of State Police and related cases addressing the remedial limits of 1983. And I think in this regard, it's worthwhile to look a little bit at the mechanics of 1983 jurisprudence under Will. And what that case turned upon was that neither state agencies nor state officials acting in their official capacity is a person when a retroactive relief is sought. And this is similar to kind of the same line that is drawn under 11th Amendment jurisprudence, where it may be okay to ask a federal court to issue prospective injunctive relief against state officials to conform their conduct to the requirements of federal law, but a retroactive award of damages that impacts the state treasury is prohibited under both 11th Amendment and 1983 jurisprudence. But it's what we argued below was the funds that we seek are not state funds. The funds we seek never have lawfully resided in the state treasury and could never lawfully emanate from the state treasury. And it's worth spending some time here to say why federal funds are at issue. And going back to this court's decision in the 2007 case, the court recognized that what happens when a state Medicaid agency fails to pay for its fair share of when a health center such as TLC provides services to Medicaid recipients. And this court even quoted from Congress's legislative history in 1989 that says that the goal of mandating a certain level of Medicaid payment is to make sure that Section 330 funds under Section 330 of the Public Health Service Act, which is slated for the uninsured, are not diverted and used for the Medicaid program. So you have Congress going as far back as 1989 tying these two programs being the Medicaid program and the Section 330 Public Health Service Act program, tying them together. And there's a comprehensive statutory scheme here, and there's an intent here as to how it's supposed to work. So here we've been contending that when the state fails to make the supplemental payments that have been at issue in this case, it forces health centers to draw their Section 330 funds down for the uninsured.
Now, you just said their Section 330 funds, which implies that we're not, in fact, dealing with federal funds anymore, but dealing with monies that, whether directly or indirectly, have been allotted to the state treasury.
The Section 330 funds have been awarded under a notice of grant award to health centers such as TLC. So it's the health center that's holding these Section 330 funds. And when the state, under the Public Health Service Act grant program, and so when the state Medicaid agency doesn't pay sufficiently, the Section 330 funds end up being subsidized, end up being used by the health center to support its ongoing operations. And so it's as if the state has effected an offset of Section 330 funds by not paying sufficiently on the Medicaid side. So if you think of it as an offset that's taking place because the health center is not getting paid sufficiently for its Medicaid program, and then it has to then divert its Section 330 dollars in order to maintain ongoing operations. And this is something that Congress recognized in legislative history. We refer to it in our papers as the last dollar concept. Congress said that this does happen when in 1988 legislative history. It does happen when it could be Medicaid not paying sufficiently. It could be the Medicare program not paying sufficiently. Other payers. So it's also worth noting as part of this comprehensive statutory scheme that Section 330 health centers have to make every reasonable effort to collect as a condition of their Public Health Service Act, Section 330 grant award. They have to make every reasonable effort to collect from these other payers. And that's a statutory requirement under the Public Health Service Act.
It's just a little hard to conceptualize it as anything other than retrospective.
I know, Your Honor, but I think the other part of the statutory scheme is that health centers are also required by virtue of cost accounting standards that apply to them, that when they do get their funds, they have to apply it back to the program. So whatever they do collect ends up going back to the Section 330 program to their project, and so it's more remedial.
But you don't really dispute, though, do you, the sort of basic garden variety principle that 1983 just doesn't authorize retrospective damages?
But we're saying here, no, I don't dispute
that. You don't dispute that. With that.
But we're saying here that it's not retrospective damages, that it is really of a remedial nature because a health center has to, it's along the lines of what the Supreme Court authorized.
But it's remedial for past harm. Going forward, apparently there doesn't seem to be any dispute about it, that TLC's transfer to the APS system cures the complaint. So going forward, I don't think there's any suggestion that TLC has grounds for complaint. What you're doing is looking backward for damages that you claim were owing for past violations.
We're looking for payments due to claims that arose in the past, yes. But I think it's somewhat artificial to look at the PPS versus the APS that the health center is now under. No matter what, the state has an obligation to comply under federal law.
And you're not disputing the fact that they're going to do that going forward, which is the kind of relief one can usually get against a state.
That's right. But for us, we're saying that this is along the lines of an equitable remedy. It's returning money, and even the Supreme Court in Bowen versus Massachusetts recognized that money itself can be at like a specie type of claim. I can address that a little bit. The Bowen said that the fact that a judicial remedy may require one party to pay money to another is not a sufficient reason to characterize the relief as money damages. That there is an award of money can be a specie remedy. So it's not really compensation because the health center is required under federal law to apply what it will get back to its project. It will benefit the Public Health Service Act program purposes, and it'll be for purposes that are consistent with what Congress originally appropriated and authorized these funds to go to. So it's consistent with what Congress's role in terms of appropriating federal dollars. And we've also cited to a number of cases that discuss that these funds remain federal until they're expended for the purposes for which they were appropriated. And so when they never got expended for the purposes for which they're appropriated because they were diverted and used as an improper subsidy. So that's the heart of our argument in terms of why the court didn't never fought the premise that these are federal funds that are at issue, but it did not agree with us in terms of what the impact is in terms under will. We also think that the court erred in finding that TLC is not entitled to prospective relief. The state has been saying that transition to the APS, it was a kind of a closeout, and that there's nothing left to be done. There are no other payments left for it to make. But we think that it's kind of artificial, whether you call it a PPS or APS, it's the administrative means that the state is putting into effect in order to fulfill a federal requirement.
That argument, I guess, suggests that the state was required to instantaneously, transition into this new form of making payments. That's not what the initial district court order mandated, did it?
The original district court order, the 2008 order,
right.
gave them some time. And our health center, it didn't matter to us whether it was the APS or some other mechanism. It was just that the APS was always held out as the way, practically speaking, the other health centers are doing it, and the state represented to us that was the best way to go about it.
Is there? Do you dispute that? Because I didn't see that, so I'm a little curious about your characterization.
Well,
now
our concern now is that is more the contention that with the old system being dormant, there's nothing that the state can do to go back.
Can we just stay with my question for just a moment? Is there a problem with the APS going forward from TLC's perspective?
Going forward, no. I mean, I'm sure there's really typical ins and outs kind of issues that arise. I'm sure it's right. Not a perfect issue, but there's nothing here that we're claiming.
I just wanted, that was my understanding.
Sure.
That was what I was just trying to clarify.
Sure. So, but we think it's artificial to say that there was this closeout on the day that the APS went into effect and that the old system is now dormant. It can't be revived. And this court's 2007 opinion emphasized that no matter how the state chooses to administer its supplemental payment program, it must do so in a way that's compliant with federal law. So whether it's one way or another, we think that there's still room for a prospective relief to be awarded, because there are still claims that could be processed. The district court didn't agree with us because they said that there were claims that there was a closeout, that there were these reconciliation reports, but that's at conflict with the district court's earlier opinion in January that said that the system was opaque, not transparent. So we have a little bit of a dissonance between those two aspects of the decision. So in any event, the relief that we sought is prospective, whether you look at what the court could have ordered after this court's decision in 2007 or what the court issued in February of 2008. And I can see my time is up.
And you have some time for rebuttal.
Thank you
very much. Mr. Davis.
Good morning. May it please the court. On behalf of the Maryland Department of Health and Mental Hygiene, I'd like to first address the appeal by three lower counties, which I'll refer to as TLC. This case concerns TLC's claim under Section 1983 for retroactive supplemental payments in the amount of $1.7 million over a nine-year period under the now-defunct prospective payment system, which I'll refer to as PPS, a system that was no longer in use by the time TLC filed suit. Maryland Medicaid made a final payment to TLC under the APS for every quarter from 2001 through 2009, by which time TLC had already joined the APS and sought retrospective payments. Now, there is no dispute that if these payments are considered compensatory rather than remedial, TLC is not entitled to recover them. Now, there are three reasons why this is the case. First, as to the scope of Section 1983, the district court correctly recognized that, quote, the alleged unpaid claims cannot conceivably be characterized as pending, unquote. Under the Supreme Court's Edelman decision and this court's Antrican decision written by Judge Niemeyer, Section 1983 only provides a cause of action for claims for prospective injunctive relief where there is a continuing violation of federal law. And under Will, in suits originally brought in state court, as this one was, and where the 11th Amendment defense does not apply, a state is not a person under Section 1983 for claims seeking past payments. Now, inasmuch as this suit was filed after TLC left the PPS was no longer in operation and the alleged state misconduct was in the past. Thus, there was no reason for a court order in this case to compel the state to comply with the PPS. The only reason for the relief that TLC requested in this case was to collect retroactive payments that the state disputes are owed. And to borrow the language of Edelman, this is the classic case in which the requested relief is, quote, in practical terms, indistinguishable from a damages claim against the state. Now, as this court held in Antrican, the key factor in determining whether Section 1983 provides a remedy is whether the relief sought is prospective or retroactive. Now, you heard counsel argue today and in TLC's papers that a different test should apply because only Section 330 funds are at issue in this case. Now, there are several problems with this argument. First, the department did demonstrate by affidavit that any repayment would require state funds. That affidavit is on page 166 of the record. Second, the source of the funds, whether they are state or federal, is immaterial because Section 1983 imposes a bar whenever it is the state that has to write the check. And even if the repayment of the funds would have no impact on the state treasury, the Supreme Court recognized in the Regents of University of California case, which we've cited in our papers, that sovereign immunity would still apply. So not surprisingly, TLC has not cited any court that has adopted its Section 330 theory, much less courts in this circuit. Now, the second reason why Section 1983 fails in this case is because Maryland has not waived its sovereign immunity. And under Alden, sovereign immunity may be waived by a state or by Congress, but neither of these exceptions applies in this case. First, the state has not consented to a suit for damages. Maryland's approach to sovereign immunity here is very similar to those of the federal courts interpreting the 11th Amendment, and that is to say that relief is limited to prospective injunctive relief and requires an ongoing violation of law. And here I would refer the court to the Stern case, which we've cited in our papers, a decision of the Maryland Court of Appeals, and also Jackson v. Glover. Maryland sovereign immunity law is also holds that only the Maryland General Assembly can waive the state's sovereign immunity, and here the legislature has not done so. And secondly, it is possible under certain circumstances for Congress to abrogate the state's sovereign immunity, but Congress did not do so when it enacted the Medicaid Act. It clearly did not intend to condition the state's participation in the Medicaid program on a state's intent to waive its immunity. The very strict requirements of the Atascadero test are not met here. And the third and final reason why TLC is not entitled to retroactive relief is that Rule 70 provides no remedy in this case under the undisputed facts. And here, the district court's very thorough review of the facts is found on pages 316 through 319 of the joint appendix. Briefly summarized, Judge Andre Davis's February 25th, 2008 order that TLC actually drafted in this case, the predecessor case, TLC 1, that is to say, and seeks to enforce in the current litigation, TLC 2, did not require that DHMH, my client, make payments to TLC. And that order can be found on page 18 of the joint appendix. The language only required the department to, quote, bring its supplemental payment system into compliance with federal law, unquote. More particularly, it only required the department to work with TLC to develop a plan to transition TLC to the APS. And this was the action that TLC chose to pursue when it drafted the order. And as the district court concluded in our case in TLC 2, TLC clearly obtained the relief it sought when it transitioned to the APS effective January 2010. The order, very importantly, did not compel the department to provide the payments that TLC requests. And then 2.5 years went by. TLC did not take any action in TLC 1, and then it filed an instant lawsuit. It could have sought an order in TLC 1. It could have sought a show cause order alleging noncompliance. It could have appealed through the state administrative process, bearing in mind that TLC was receiving quarterly letters from the state indicating the amount of reconciliation payments to which it was entitled, but TLC didn't do either of these things. So it's our position that the language of Judge Davis's 2008 order is simply too vague and too indefinite to support a finding of civil contempt under Rule 70. Or as the district court summarized the evidence, there's no order compelling the payments that TLC seeks in the TLC 1 litigation. There's no judgment enforceable under Rule 70, and most importantly, there's no failure on the part of the department to comply with the court's direction. Now, on our cross-appeal, I'd like to turn to that. There's no dispute that the department has required the managed care organizations to reimburse the FQHCs for out-of-network services. The issue raised by our cross-appeal is whether the department had to amend each of its MCO provider agreements to require that they pay for these out-of-network services on an emergent basis, or whether its transmittal and regulations were legally sufficient. I have 3 points here. First, paragraph 1A of the department's provider agreement specifically requires the MCOs to comply with all transmittals and regulations of the Medicaid program. This is found at page 101 of the joint appendix. Now, it's undisputed that the department did issue a transmittal requiring the MCOs to provide these payments. And under Maryland contract law, the transmittal was incorporated by implication into the provider agreement.
That's certainly persuasive, but the district court pays more attention to its remand orders, I suspect, and we were pretty clear in TLC 1. In plain language, this section, the section of the statute, requires states to include in their contracts with managed care organizations a provision that requires reimbursement for emergency services.
Yes, Your Honor. I think the key phrase is there to include in their contracts. And it's our position that the contract does so include. This court in TLC 1 did not have an opportunity to consider the court's incorporation by implication argument, which we're now raising here. We think that...
Could TLC sue on the basis of the regulation if they believe that compensation is inadequate? Don't they have stronger remedies if it's incorporated into the contract itself? They can sue for breach?
I think they could sue for breach in either event, Your Honor. They would be a third-party beneficiary of the contract between the state and the MCO. And on either theory, either the express language theory, which TLC is arguing applies here, or the incorporation by implication theory, which we say is sufficient, TLC could enforce that right and could prevail. Now, after the district court issued its January 2011 opinion that the transmittal lacked the force of law, the department issued a regulation which took effect in August of 2011, which the district court did acknowledge that had the force of law. This time, however, the court held that the department had to actually amend each of the MCO provider agreements, and there were unspecified, quote, problematic documentation requirements. Now, our second argument here is that the court's hyper-technical construction ignores the language of the statute. As I indicated in response to your question, Judge Duncan, we think that the language of the statute is broad enough to include the corporation by reference scheme that the state has adopted here. The bottom line is that TLC, in its complaint, alleges that the state failed to provide it out-of-network payments, and we asked in discovery whether there was any evidence to support this allegation, and TLC's response is on page 338 of the record, that they refer to documents which don't give us the answer.
Well, the district court expressed concern about potentially problematic verification requirements
right.
in the transmittal and in the regulation. And in fact, the regulation does impose certain requirements that go beyond what I think to be required by the Medicaid Act itself.
Well, the district court didn't say what those documentation problems were. In fact, state regulations do require providers of services to document any claims that arise. For example, under one of our regulations, which applies to freestanding medical clinics, FQHCs generally, any payment to an FQHC must show the date of service, the medical complaint, the physical findings, the service provided, and the doctor's signature.
And that, I think, it was the district court's point, that some of the requirements exceed that those imposed by the Medicaid Act, and yet TLC could be denied reimbursement for emergency services as required because it failed to comply with documentation requirements imposed by the state, not imposed by the federal government.
Well, that is what the district court concluded, but there was really no evidence that TLC had been denied any payments whatsoever.
Well, not yet, but that's not the point. The point is whether or not an enforceable obligation exists in the case of a violation of the Medicaid Act.
Right.
And the court expressed concern that the provisions of the regulation might prevent that to the harm of TLC in a way that doesn't contravene the requirements of the Medicaid Act.
Well, we respectfully disagree with the district court's opinion for two reasons, Your Honor. The Medicaid statute under discussion here requires that there be the provision of emergency services to an out-of-network provider, an FQHC.
Yes, I understand that. But, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to add that all the regulation does is require that the FQHC verify that the services are, in fact, immediately required. I mean, how could it be an emergency unless there's some verification that the services are immediately required?
I don't know, but that was the concern expressed by the district court, that there do appear to be other requirements, and that may not be the only one that the TLC has to comply with that are not mandated by the Medicaid Act, but would nevertheless interfere with payment under the Medicaid Act.
Right, and we can only guess what the district court's concerns were, because neither TLC nor the district court gave any details as to what the concerns are.
Can you explain why the state chose to proceed via this transmittal requirement and then a regulation instead of simply doing what the plain language of the remand suggests needs to be done, that is to modify the contracts?
Your Honor, we have seven FQHCs in the state of Maryland, but we have 55,000 provider agreements, or 55,000 providers, many of whom are home health care aides. And we think it's a bad law to require the state, whenever there is an issue that arises with respect to a provider, to amend each and every provider agreement. So we are hoping that it is sufficient to, for the state, in the interest of administrative flexibility and the state's discretion to operate a program with the least administrative burden, to be able to use transmissions and regulations.
Were those concerns expressed to the district court?
I believe we did, yes, Your Honor. Okay, the second point of the regulation, which relates to the documentation requirement, is to simply verify that the patient's primary doctor is unavailable, which to the state is part of the emergency inquiry. And in fact, TLC had suggested to us when we were drafting the regulation, and this is on page 93 of the record, that that's how they do it, and we simply adopted their suggestion. We thought it was a good suggestion. We put it in the regulation, and now they are protesting that it constitutes a burdensome requirement.
I do understand. You understand that it has the flavor of your criticizing the district court for doing exactly what we told the district court to do in what may very well be the law of the case.
I don't think it is the law of the case, Your Honor, respectfully, because the court, this court, did not have the opportunity to consider the incorporation by reference argument that we're making here. And if the panel has no other questions, that's my argument. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Galati, you have some time reserved for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think I'll start with the out-of-network issue, since that's just where everyone left off. Congress has said that as a matter of federal law, this out-of-network issue is important enough for it to be put into the contracts between state Medicaid agencies and managed care organizations. I don't think there's any requirement that all, Mr. Davis quoted a very high number in terms of how many provider agreements would need to be amended. There's only, I believe, 5, 6, or 7 managed care organizations that have contracts with the department. So that's what we're talking about. I'm sure the number is probably under 10. It's not in the thousands. In any event, this and if I am on behalf of TLC am trying to raise a third-party beneficiary argument along the lines of what you inquired, Your Honor, I don't want to have to rely on incorporation by reference. I want to be able to say that this is an explicit requirement in the contract, and I want to be held to what Congress has said that is required as a matter of federal law. Not when I'm facing the managed care organization and there's a dispute about payment, I don't want to be held to some question as to whether there's some issue about whether we complied with verification requirements that are not statutorily required. So I think that addresses our responses on the out-of-network issue. With respect to the motion to enforce issue, we ended up having we did get that order from Judge Davis in February of 2008. We believe that some of the prefatory language at the beginning of the order does find that there is an ongoing violation by the department with respect to payment. We knew, practically speaking, that at the outset of the case, we had requested a status conference. We know that we're not going to get an order from a court saying you're entitled to X amount of dollars. There, most likely the court was going to require us to engage in some back and forth with the state in order to determine the amounts that were going to be paid. So practically speaking, we tried to go and engage in some back and forth, have a status conference with the state, and we got stymied. And that's why we ended up having to file suit. There was some progress made with the APS in terms of going forward, but there was this gap in terms of what was going backwards. Let's see. And I have nothing else if there are no other questions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Mr. Davis, I believe.
Awesome.
Thank you very much. We will come down and greet counsel and proceed directly to the last case.